Today's program is brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cain5.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, joining you from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on this eve of a major snowstorm on the most traveled day of the year leading into Thanksgiving. I am traveling all the way across the street, which is exactly how I like it. I have nowhere to go except my in-laws' house, and they are hosting, and I am in charge of bringing a cherry pie. So for anyone who is stressing out about their flight and all that, I feel sorry for you, but I have to say you brought this on yourself. I highly recommend living across the street from your family in case there's a bearing down snowstorm on days where you're expected to be somewhere. That being said, there are people chuckling in the background, so I want to welcome Anne, the producer of the show. Hi, Anne.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
All right.
Did you have a good week?
Always.
Okay. And we have Vanessa, who's joining us from NYU's Food and Nutrition Studies program. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello.
She's getting some exposure. Someone that I work with over at NYU said, can you help her out? She wants some exposure to food media. And so I'm going to do my best to appear very well prepared and organized and give you as best an introduction into food radio as I can.
Great.
But you've been hanging out with Jack all day too. So you'll see someone way more organized than I am, Jack, the engineer of the show. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
I had not prepared you for jumping in at any point.
No, I'm here.
Flawless entry to the show as usual. And my first guest, this is going to be a packed show. First guest, Eugenia Bone, who has written a new book called The Kitchen Ecosystem. But let me first say hi, Eugenia.
Hi there.
So you came in with a pint container of brown solids, and you said, I want to hand this to you before we go on air. And I opened it, and it filled the entire studio with the smell of maple syrup.
Right.
So your previous title, previous to The Kitchen Ecosystem, you wrote a book called Mycophilia.
Yes.
So tell me what's in this pint container.
So since you're a chef, and I was thinking, what can I bring her that she doesn't make herself that would be kind of fun? So I brought some candy cap mushrooms that I collected in California actually 2 years ago, because last year there was no rain. And the candy cap mushroom is a little brown lactarious mushroom that dries really well.
It's used. Wait, what do you mean when you say lactarious?
That's like the genus
of
the mushroom.
Okay, perfect.
But there's a few species that are in the group called candy cap that are known colloquially as candy cap mushrooms.
Okay.
And they all have, you know, this kind of mapley or sometimes a little curry or fenugreek sort of flavor. When you use them, when they're fresh, we use them in savory applications. And when they're dried, it concentrates that sweetness and they make this wonderful, strange sauce, really, or syrup.
So how did you add anything to them to get this sauciness? Because they are in liquid.
Right. So I rehydrated them in water and then added sugar to the water, to this now flavorful brown water. Added sugar, made a simple syrup, and just cooked the mushrooms in it. That's it. And I have to say, I made it quite a while ago.
Okay.
Now, sorry about that. They're totally okay. They're wonderfully okay.
So I have a after school special level of fear about eating foraged mushrooms, which was ingrained in me by my mother, who we were not allowed to even touch mushrooms that were growing out in the woods. It was such a phobia that we would eat something with, I think, well-founded fear that we would be exploratory and try something and then we would be dead. And so I'm going to eat this, and my husband, who will listen to this show, is going to be like, he's going to freak out because I have not allowed him to eat anything that grows in our lawn, that things that he swears are morals. I'm like, absolutely
okay, so
not.
What's your husband's name?
His name is Mark.
Mark. Let me just tell you that when she eats these mushrooms, her afterwards, her, like, if she works out, you know, her sweat will smell like maple syrup. And in fact, all of the liquids in her body will smell like liquid, like maple syrup, in which case you might change your mind about these mushrooms.
He wants to eat them. I'm the one telling them that he cannot. And I will. I'm going to give you and the listeners TMI. Are we, Anne, can I do that?
I'm ready.
You support this decision?
I always support TMI.
So I nursed my son, and it was not, I did not love nursing, and I did it, but it was not easy and not enjoyable for me. But one of the old wives' tales that I was told was to take fenugreek tabs because it would help with milk production. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that changed was that every part of me smelled like maple syrup.
It's wild, right? It's an intense thing. It's
okay,
really
so
cool.
I'm gonna taste it, and then I'm gonna pass around. You want to try one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, here it goes. These. So it looks. It has a light resemblance to a shiitake. It has like a wide, round cap with a small stem in the center and gills of the same color.
You know, in the mycological world, we call them LBMs, little brown mushrooms.
This is like candy.
I know.
Oh, because it's called a candy cap.
Yeah.
Aren't they awesome? They're so strange.
This is the weirdest thing I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
People ask me that question a lot, and I never know. Now I have an answer.
Yeah.
I mean, in the most pleasurable way.
Yeah. They're strange and wonderful. That. But that's the thing about mushrooms, just on a culinary basis. They are very, their variety so and their attributes are totally underestimated by the most
so
dining
how
public.
Do you know what you can eat and what you can't eat? Like, so my husband, we used to live in a place where these, what I assume he's right, were morals that would pop up under this particular tree. And everything that I see on the internet, which is where I got most of my information, was like there's morals and there's false morals, and they're very easy to tell apart. And if it's hollow in the middle, it's fine, or it's not, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. Hollow in the middle is fine, yeah.
Is that really fine?
You know, it's just like anything else that you forage for outside. I mean, if you're not going to go and just eat a berry because it's red, and you know that strawberries are red. You know, there's a number of indicators, and they will help you navigate that identification. But the best way to learn about mushrooms is, if you're a New Yorker, just join the New York Mycological Society. We go out every weekend, and then we have Gary Linkoff, who's known as the Woody Allen of mycology. He's fabulous. And you learn about the mushrooms. When you see them in their habitat, it's really, really much easier to identify them in the future.
Okay. Will you permit me to take the balance of those mushrooms that we don't
eat
home to my husband? Because if I don't, I may never get spoken to again.
Oh, good. All right. So he's the one who's going to have the sweet smelling sweat.
Right. Yes. He's going to have, we will both, our kid's going to wonder what happened to mommy and daddy.
They're going to want pancakes.
Okay. So your new book is called The Kitchen Ecosystem.
Yes.
So much like mushrooms are part of a larger ecosystem, you have designed this book to give people what? Like, how did you conceive of it? How did you come to find this concept?
Well, the instigating factor or story, I suppose, is that many years ago, my first book was called At Mace's Edge, and it was a memoir and also all these recipes. And a friend threw a party and asked everybody to bring bring dishes from the book. And they were all good. Everyone was very happy and appreciative and so on. But I thought the dishes, you know, privately, weren't punchy enough. They didn't taste as intensely flavorful as mine. And after a few phone calls and a little investigation, I realized it's because where I was using homemade chicken stock, they were using commercial. Where I was using homemade mayonnaise, they were using commercial. And so I started thinking about this idea of why, of the ingredients, the working parts, you could almost say like the individual parts of a kitchen, the quality of those parts reflects the overall health of your cuisine. And I've just used the like paradigm of an ecosystem because it's consistent, you know, it works the same for both.
Right. And you have these flow charts that are in the book of the order in which you can cook and then utilize different components of a dish.
Right. Those are clads. Actually, that's like hangover from my mycophilia research, you know, and I got kind of into serious nerdification. So cladograms are like family trees. Mm-hmm. They show the evolutionary relationship between things. And in the case of this book, I'll go from apples to zucchini, including proteins and shellfish and so on, and say on the like first generation is eat some fresh. The next generation is preserve some. The third generation is use those preserves. And the fourth generation is to use the waste stream. So it's a way of looking at your food in over time, really. Like, what are you going to eat today, and what can you eat in a week or a month or you know, or a year?
When I went back to work after having my son, I have found that that level of planning, it, you know, on a Sunday to take an hour or two to figure out how I'm going to utilize, you know, a whole chicken, it makes the whole week so much easier.
Totally.
Because I don't have to think about it every single day. And instead, I have a plan for, like, these different things. And that you've gone and, like, put it into words.
Yeah.
I don't have, even have to, like, I could just open your book and have you tell me what to do. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, and there's these really basic concepts, like, don't buy chicken parts. Buy the whole chicken.
Right.
To buy chicken parts is a ripoff because
right.
you don't get the bones. Same goes with the fish. And then, you know, these people get all, I don't know how to make stock. And I really think that these are such simple techniques. These and any cooking. I mean, you can go out to, you can go find something that's hard to do. But by and large, cooking is simpler, I think, than balancing a checkbook. So, you know, it's just a little bit of mastery. If you make stock a few times, you're never going to need to use a recipe again.
Right.
And getting over the idea that you have these sort of pre-World War II volumes, like you have to do stock with two chicken carcasses. You know, why not do enough stock in a little saucepan to make 1 pint of stock? I mean, what's wrong with that?
That was
actually
convenient. Yeah, that was a huge revelation also, where I was like, oh, I can just use, like, this one chicken carcass and a carrot and some celery stems, and it'll be better than what you could buy in a carton. And it doesn't have to be, I don't have to figure out how I'm going to deal with, you know, like 6 gallons in my biggest stock pot when it's, you know, finally cooled off.
It's really like the idea of small batch canning. Mm-hmm. It's just, for me, it's like small batch everything that's for tomorrow.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to toss the baton to Vanessa. But here's my one hang up about doing small batch things, and I can picture my pantry in my kitchen right now with 4 examples without even thinking too hard of things that I have fetishized that I have 1 or 2 of. Mm. That I'm like, oh, like, we have this really good celery jam that I didn't even make. Someone else made it, but I'm like, once I open it, then it's gone and we don't have it anymore. And it's not getting any better. It's not, you know, improving with age. Now it's a solid year old. And all because I was too scared to use it, which is like my own psychology.
Yeah, I do that too. You know, I get attached to stuff and, you know, hoarding is hoarding. Pantry hoarders are just the same as any other kind of hoarders. I did a pantry intervention just a few days ago in Memphis. Oh my God, the stuff we found.
Wait, was this a friend or did someone contract you to come over?
No, I'm not. I'm not for sale. I only do it if somebody lets me, really. You know, if you look at the USDA sort of rules about canning, it always suggests that you use stuff within a year. That's not because it won't be okay in more than a year, but it's really so you starting to think seasonally. You should be done with your strawberry jam in June of 1 year. You know, so just take a look at what you actually eat. If you have somebody in the household who's under 5, you may need more strawberry jam than I do as a middle-aged woman with a husband hanging around. You know, we don't eat that much strawberry jam. So it's, you know, that's what an intervention would say. You know, look at what you really eat, can what that is.
Right.
And then as far as, you know, hoarding, I got to remind you of 9/11. You know, after that, everybody was drinking their good burgundies. And it was like, you didn't know what was going to happen next.
Silver linings. You're right. You're absolutely right. Okay, I've been wanting to open that celery jam in particular, and I feel like you've given me permission to do it.
Oh,
and,
baby,
and
yes.
The other hoarder mark in my life, I'm going to buy them off with some maple-flavored mushrooms.
Oh, too. Fantastic.
Okay, so Vanessa, you take the mic and ask Eugenia your questions that are going to help round you out as a food media studies person.
So you talk in your book about how preparing foods in advance becomes habitual. And I think for a lot of us, it's really hard to start these new behaviors. Some people don't really know much about cooking or food. How do you develop these habits, and how do you suggest others begin?
Well, this is, for me, it was the same way as I'm going to suggest others do it, except that I did it a long time ago, so now I have a real old growth pantry. But if someone young who's just starting out, or somebody who's not pursuing their cooking the way we're talking about today, I think the first thing to do is stop and say, what do I buy frequently? I mean, am I buying a lot of mayonnaise? That means I'm using a lot of mayonnaise. If I'm using a lot of mayonnaise, then maybe I should consider replacing that mayonnaise that I buy with a homemade version in a few tries, you're going to master it, because mayonnaise takes like 5 minutes to do, and you can use good organic eggs, and you can really control the quality. And I guarantee that every dish that you make with that mayonnaise in the future is going to taste better. And then it's a matter of acquiring. Do you buy a lot of tomato? You know, whatever you buy a lot of, one by one, I would recommend folding into your cooking repertoire substitutes that are homemade. And you'll find that the overall level of your dining will start to rise. And then it becomes addictive.
Awesome. So how do you also think that busier people can learn how to adopt preservation methods?
You know, I am starting this project in January. I have a little blog, The Kitchen Ecosystem, where I'm going to try to just do what I'm talking about doing in the morning and in the evening, you know, because I know it can be done. It's just that as a food writer, that's what I'm doing all day long. So I don't, you know, I need to figure out how that's done. But I would think that the main way to do it is to plan, you know, to keep in mind what's going on. So if you you defrost overnight, say a flank steak, you put it in a marinade in the morning so that when you get home, all you got to do is grill it and you're done. That kind of thing is going to open up your free time to be more improvisational. And the thing about preserving, people have this idea that they need to spend a half a day at it. I'll tell you how I preserve. Instead of buying 1 pound of tomatoes to make it, say, a tomato and watermelon salad for dinner, I'll buy 2 pounds of tomatoes. 1 pound of tomato, I'll make a tomato and watermelon salad. And the other pound, I'll shove into a pint jar and process in my asparagus cooker, which is like, but you can also get these really small little apartment size bowl pressure cookers, although I have a small one of those too, All American, very cute. But water bath canners, and process that 1 pint of tomatoes. And you have one meal, one marinara sauce prepared. Then this is just another burner going at the same time as you're cooking dinner anyway. I'm not talking about separating it out from your regular cooking routine. But whatever you're having for dinner, you preserve a little bit of it at the same time. You're cooking lamb with lemons. You have a few extra lemons, which you shove into a jar with salt. So you have some preserved lemons to enjoy, to really bump up the flavor of a meal in another month. So that's how I do it. The two shouldn't be separated. Preserving is cooking. Cooking is preserving.
I'm going to jump back in. This is Chef Emily. Eugenia Bone, this has been so enlightening. I would love to have you back on the show anytime.
Great.
You
love
are
to.
Wonderful to talk to.
Thanks.
The book is called The Kitchen Ecosystem. It is available wherever books are sold. The other previous title is Mycophilia for the mushroom. And I love that you called yourself a nerd. I call myself a nerd, too. And I just love girl nerds in general. So thank you for coming on
thank
the show.
You.
I truly appreciate it. And after the break, we are going to talk to Smitri Keshari and Carl Banks, producers of the new documentary Food Chains.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, joining you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Before we start talking about this new documentary that I'm really obsessed with called Food Chains, I need to give a special thank you to Craft Coffee, who I received my monthly mailing of Craft Coffee to my mailbox this week. If you go to craftcoffee.com, sign up for a subscription service, they will mail boxes of coffee directly to your mailbox so you don't have to think about it. And then once a month, you go in there, open it up, and they have selected hand-grown, handcrafted artisanal coffees just for you. Use the code SHARP at checkout, and you'll get 10% off your order. Okay, so joining me in the studio, I haven't gotten those transitions down. So I have to figure out a way to do that more smoothly. But thank you, Craft Coffee. And now we're going to talk about something completely different. I'll use the Monty Python approach too.
Excellent.
Changing topic. So joining me in the studio are the producers of the new film documentary called Food Chains, Carl Banks. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how's it going?
And Smriti.
Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Did I get it correct that time?
That was perfect.
Thank you for coming to the studio. So introduce this new film for us, if you would. You will do a much more eloquent job of it than I will, but this is a cause that I feel very, very passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as you know, there's this vast interest in food these days, and a lot of questions are being asked about the food. You know, what's in it? Is it sustainable? Is it organic? And yet, when we started this in the summer of 2011, Carl, myself, the director, Sanjay Revel, and our great DP, Forrest Woodward, we realized that there was absolutely no information or questions being asked about the hands that picked that food. And that's really why we set off on this journey. We went around the country to California and Florida. We were in Detroit. We were in Vermont. And we spoke with many farm workers on the road. We heard cases of abuses, exploitation, wage theft, women facing sexual harassment. And yet when it came to the solution, all of the hands pointed us to the work of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a group of tomato pickers in Florida. And that's really where the narrative of our film began. It's their plight and their fight against supermarkets.
And so I'll tell you that I spent a week a couple of summers ago immediately following culinary school. Someone got my resume through like a headhunter to fill in for someone in a corporate cafeteria. And it was an environment I'd never worked in before. I grew up on a family farm. We raised our own tomatoes. Lots of farmers markets around, or, you know, farm stand corner vegetables were available throughout the summer. And it wasn't something that I'd given a lot of thought to until I was in this corporate cafeteria. And there were just boxes of tomatoes, and it was one of the first times where I wonder, like, where did these come from? Like, are there just giant greenhouses? Like, how are these getting to us? And so you have made this film that sheds light on the struggle between the supermarkets and the farm workers. And one of the things that I have tried to navigate through in my own thinking about food choices is how much can the consumer really change? And I think what your film does a good job of saying is it's going to happen when the supermarkets change, and then it's going to trickle down to the consumers, but that the onus is on us to put the pressure on the supermarkets. So give me a little bit of background about how people can, what can people do when they're like, I want things to get better.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at the most kind of basic level, as you were stating, I think people don't realize, they don't think beyond the supermarket or beyond the farmer's market. Things have always been marketed to us to look a certain way, and to have this picturesque idea of where it comes from, that there's a farm just down the corner, and that's where it's coming from. And yet, supermarkets are a giant industry. I mean, they make more money than the tech industry, and that's shocking.
I didn't know that.
Shocking to so many. I mean, Walmart Grocery, Safeway, Kroger's, Publix, they're making more money than Monsanto, than Apple, than MasterCard. It's surprising. Yeah.
That's very surprising.
And that kind of, that value of the brand, that value that they have created, that's kind of where all of it lies for them. And so the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the CIW's Fair Food Program, was ingenious in a way of realizing that supermarkets really had all of the power and fast food retailers. And to get them to listen and to get them to care, the best way was to target their consumers. And so they started with the Taco Bell boycotts by getting college students to boycott Taco Bell in campuses. And now since then, there's been 12 major retailers that have signed on, including Walmart.
And Publix is holding out, right?
Yep.
And how much more money would it cost us in order for this to change?
Well, their program is just, they just say a penny a pound. That's all they want to do, is just increase it one penny a pound. Now, most of the fast food, they'll just eat that because their brand is too important. But they, even to the consumer, I mean, you're talking, you know, $2.99 to $3 a pound. Everybody would be happy to pay that. And the key is that it goes directly to the farm workers. It's not lost in the food chain.
Right.
And but what's more important than that, the penny of the pound, a pound is, you know, a fun thing to talk about. But what's more important than that is they sign on to a code of conduct that says that they can't sell tomatoes from certain growers if they're found, you know, violating these certain codes, which is the most important part of the Fair Food Program.
And how do we know that retailers have signed on to that? Do they get a sticker like the snail for slow food, or does that get something like that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So there's 12 major retailers, and on our website, Food Chains Film, you can find out that information and other info on how to get involved and see the film. But as of this fall, they're releasing a Fair Food label. And they waited, and this is why I really respect them, they waited 5 years of the program being in effect to create it, because they wanted to make sure that the mechanism, and the enforcement mechanism specifically, was in fact working and valuable. And so there's a new label. It's green. It has a farm worker with tomatoes. And it's going to be rolled out in the fall, in the late fall, in Whole Foods and select cafeterias around the country.
And this was a movement of the workers by the workers and who made this happen, which I think is so important. Instead of it being like, I mean, as much as like do-gooders are important, it wasn't us who went and created this and said, here, we're going to help. It came internally. And I think that's so, so important.
Yeah, that's the most important thing. They're the ones, the people on the ground are the ones that know best what to do, how to handle these sort of injustices and these situations. And also, their model is being used in all sorts of activism now, because they're a coalition. There's no head. There's no one person that's, you know, at the top of it. You take, for example, the UFW, who had you know, great successes many years ago, whenever Cesar Chavez was no longer around. Their influence kind of dwindled a little bit. They're still around, but, you know, I don't want to say anything incorrect about what they're doing, but it's just a different model. And again, it's a very useful model, and it's being used all over activism.
Yeah, and as Carl was saying, it's in the label, their tagline is, it's worker-driven and consumer-powered.
So cool.
That's so cool. How do people see the film?
People can actually see the film right now if they're in New York City. It's still playing for 2 more days at IFC and Quad Cinemas. It's actually available on iTunes, and we're opening in other cities this upcoming weekend. So it's really exciting. It's going to be on video on demand, and there's many, many ways.
Foodchainsfilm.com is the website, correct?
That's You're both right. Adding.
Every time I say something and I don't have it written down, I'm like, oh, is it .org? Okay, foodchainsfilm.com is the website. Highly, highly recommend it. And now, Carl, you brought a guitar with you.
I did.
Now, is this related to the movie, or is this your own separate portion of your life?
It is related in a way. Gil, our friend Gil, did the scoring of the movie. But when the way I got involved is they said they needed a folk singing audio man to come on the trip. And I provided a little bit of entertainment and good old fashioned folk protest songs. So,
I mean, if you're going to spend 4 years making a film, you need a musician.
Awesome. Right. It's like that cool. Old the game of like figuring out who you're going to take on the boat with you. If you have to go on a boat, it's like, okay, everyone always wants a chef. Like, you definitely have to have a chef. Do you need a nurse? Maybe. You definitely need a musician. Okay. So if you would get your guitar out, I would love to have you play us out. And before we end the show, I want to give a quick love note and thank you to Agricola in Princeton. I got taken there for my birthday dinner, which I mentioned last week, and I'm bringing it back up again because it was the first time in a really long time that I had such an excellent restaurant experience that I'm still talking about it, and I can't wait to go back again. And we got their pickle and cheese plate. Well, their pickle plate as an appetizer and their cheese plate for dessert, and we're trying to recreate the pickle plate for Thanksgiving. And when I say we, I mean my husband, because I advocate for going out to eat on Thanksgiving because all I do pretty much all the day long is cook. So on Thanksgiving, I would love to go out. But we will be enjoying family instead at home, and my husband is trying to recreate this pickle platter. So that got a little more snarky than I wanted it to. I'm very excited to have Thanksgiving dinner at home. but I just wanted to say that it's really hard to please me in a restaurant because, you know, when you work in restaurants, you know what goes into it. You know what ingredients cost. And if you are in the Princeton area, I cannot recommend Agricola highly enough. So I wanted to thank them for existing. And speaking of Thanksgiving, I wanted to give you two quick Thanksgiving tidbits that I was thinking, like, I don't want to leave you with no Thanksgiving commentary at all. I talked about how to do a bird a couple of weeks ago. But number one, I think going into this, I'm planning to control the amount of food I put on my plate the first trip to the buffet. I'm really not looking forward to feeling like overly stuffed and sick. And I feel like everyone's talking about that on the radio. And like every time I turn on the radio, it's like, tips on how to deal with your overindulgence. Even my yoga teacher on Friday is going to be all about twists to like deal with how much you ate. My goal is if there are Brussels sprouts, I can just take one Brussels sprout. I can always go back for more Brussels sprouts if they were so good, but I don't need to like heap my plate up with a full portion of everything that's on offer. I can just have a little taste and then decide if I need to eat more food. Thus not having to undo my belt buckle at the table, which is not adorable. And then the other thing is make sure you have a really good playlist going in the background so that there's not any moments that are completely silent where nobody, you know, if everybody stops talking for a second, it sounds a lot better when there's some like Ella Fitzgerald playing in the back, something not controversial that everybody likes. And I'm sure Songza is going to, or, you know, whoever it is going to put together something beautiful. So on that note, Carl, are you part of a band? Do you want to tell us the name of your band?
I'm just a solo act.
You're a solo act?
Carl Banks.
Carl Banks?
I'm, you know, located in, well, I live in Ridgewood, but I'm playing all over New York all the time, so.
Awesome.
CarlBanksMusic.tumblr.com.
There we go. All right. So we're going to go out with a song from CarlBanks.tumblr. CarlBanksMusic.tumblr.com. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Until next week, keep playing with fire and knives.
Inch by inch, row by row, I'm gonna make this garden grow. All I need is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rain comes tumbling down. Rain for grain, sun and rain, find your way in the food chain. And through my brain to the rhythm of the land. Inch by inch, row by row, I'm gonna make this garden grow. All I need is a rake and a hoe and a piece of ground. See that crow up in the tree? He's got his eyes on me. In my garden, I am as free as that feathered leaf up there. Inch by inch, row by row, I'm gonna make this garden grow. All I need is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rain comes tumbling down.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.